It is Tuesday, August 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. and Indian officials stress closer ties between the two countries.
It's obvious in terms of intelligence, law enforcement, and the militaries that they are drawing much closer together, which is very significant.
A suicide car bomber wounds three people at the Chinese embassy in Kyrgyzstan. And Canadian singer Alicia Cara promotes inner beauty in her latest single. It's all ahead. U.S. and Indian government ministers are touting a significantly expanded strategic and economic relationship, which Secretary of State John Kerry said Tuesday couldn't come at a more important moment. They spoke during the second U.S.-India Strategic and Commercial Dialogue, held for the first time in India. VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman is in New Delhi.
Secretary of State John Kerry was very upbeat about these talks. He said that they could not come at a more important moment. And it really is significant what these two governments have accomplished, really under the administrations of President Obama and the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And this is the second dialogue to be held. It's very wide-ranging. It covers just about everything you can imagine in terms of commerce and in terms of the strategic side of things, too. We should also mention that the Secretary of Commerce, Penny Pritzker, was here as well. And she was really getting down in the weeds on some issues that are a very strong concern to the Indians, such as the visa rules. As you know, there are many thousands of Indians who go to the United States to work in all fields, especially high tech. And some changes in the visa rules have been front page news here in India. And she said she's going to work with the State Department to look into this to make sure that Indians applying for these work visas in the United States are being treated fairly. Probably the big takeaway today involves the fight against terrorism, something, of course, that both governments are very involved in. The External Affairs Minister of India, Sushma Swaraj, announced that they are going to intensify intelligence sharing. And specifically, they're going to try to get into place an agreement very soon on exchanging information on known or suspected terrorists. That's the type of information that the United States has traditionally shared with some of its closest allies. And now India will be brought much closer into that sort of relationship.
And now also, what about the security side of the discussions? Were Secretary Kerry or Indian officials, did they talk much about that?
Well, they're much more restrained in telling us exactly what was going on in those talks today. The Secretary of State did meet with India's National Security Advisor, but we got a very succinct statement about what was discussed in that. But it's obvious in terms of intelligence, law enforcement, and the militaries that they are drawing much closer together, which is very significant considering that India has had this traditional policy of non-alignment. And if it wasn't hostile in past decades towards the United States, it was very suspicious because of strong and deep support that the United States had for Pakistan, especially Pakistan's military.
Yeah, there have been a number of joint drills, military drills between the two countries.
Yes. Again, something that was really unimaginable a few decades ago. There's another one that's going to come up in about a month where they're going to integrate armies out in the field for some joint drills down to the platoon level.
Did either U.S. officials or Indian officials talk about any security or military concerns regarding China?
China did not come out in any of the public statements that were made by any of the ministers here today. But obviously, we know that Beijing is watching this very closely with some concern. And it's obvious that the major reason that India is drawing itself closer to the United States in many ways is because of its long-term concerns about China. And that is something that analysts here in New Delhi have told me that they consider to be quite significant.
That's VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman reporting from New Delhi, India. Now, for a look at social media, I'm joined by editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, we have trending today, hashtag Apple tax. Now, this is dealing with Apple computers, you know, maker of the iPhone and the iPad. They've been charged by the European Union with dodging taxes and using Ireland to dodge some taxes they have to pay. So the European Union is requiring them to pay 13 billion euros. It's about 14.5 billion U.S. dollars.
Ouch.
Yes, in taxes. So that's the sentiment on social media. Ouch. A lot of Apple puns and people taking a bite out of Apple. You see that line coming up again and again. But also the sentiment that no company is too big or too prominent to avoid paying their taxes. Now, some keen social media users pointed out that a lot of people are taking aim at Apple and saying, well, it's great that this company is being charged and good that they have to pay the taxes. And then you see beneath their tweets and Facebook posts that they were sent from their iPhone or their iPad. So, you know, they're striking back against Apple, but they're still consumers of the company. So that was kind of a fun thing that people found on social media. The other big trending topic today is the passing of Gene Wilder, dead at the age of 83. Of course, known for Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, and one of my favorite movies ever, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I grew up watching that movie, I think, just about weekly. you know, the accolades coming in for him, he's calling him a comedic genius, incomparable, in a class by himself, all of these things to suggest what a great talent he was. And we're seeing a lot of the images, short clips on social media from his films. One video making the rounds is comedian James Corden gave a very moving tribute on his show about him meeting Gene Wilder and his impact that he had on his life. So sad passing of Gene Wilder, but we'll have a lot of great movies and memories to watch.
No doubt. Absolutely. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. A car bomb kills more than 20 people near the Somali presidential palace. The U.S. says Turkey and Kurdish forces both are critical in the fight against ISIS. Donald Trump is facing a pivotal campaign moment on immigration policies, and China charges an American woman with spying. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists working with what has been purported to be the world's most sensitive dark matter detector say that despite spending 20 months looking for the mysterious stuff, they have not been able to detect even a single trace of it. The large underground xenon dark matter experiment was conducted at the Sanford Underground Research Facilities located beneath about 1.6 kilometers of earth and rock in the Black Hills of South Dakota. The Lux scientists say their detector was so sensitive that if any dark matter particles had actually interacted with their device, it would have certainly pointed them out. The researchers say their experiment gathered and then later analyzed nearly 500 terabytes worth of data. Findings from the Lux experiment will be used to help those conducted in the future, such as the Lux Zeppelin experiment, which is expected to continue the search for dark matter in 2020. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a famous pop star does her civic jury duty in Tennessee. A suicide bomber crashed a car into a gate at the Chinese embassy in the capital of Kyrgyzstan Tuesday in an attack that injured three people. Kyrgyzstan's prime minister said the blast in Bishkek killed only the bomber and that the injured were Kyrgyz employees at the site. The country's interior ministry labeled it a terrorist attack. The explosion left a plume of smoke rising from the embassy compound, and photos posted on social media show debris strewn across the grounds. China condemned what it called a violent and extreme act. Raffaello Pantucci is the director of international security studies at the Royal United Services Institute in London. I asked him who are the leading suspects in this attack.
A list of potential suspects that one could point to. It is always possible that some sort of criminal activity is resulting in anger against the Chinese embassy in some way. But I think, a lot of people are looking probably towards Uyghur militancy, some sort of way as being potentially connected to this particular attack.
Why is that?
Well, the Uyghurs are a sort of minority community that exists principally in China's westernmost province of Xinjiang, which is adjacent to Kyrgyzstan. So they're a large sort of diaspora community scattered around Central Asia, in particular in Kyrgyzstan, in neighboring Kazakhstan and neighboring Uzbekistan, because the Uyghurs are a community who have a sort of language and cultural practice which is relatively proximate to the sort of Turkic Central Asian peoples. So there's sort of a diaspora scattered around. And these are communities, in China in particular, have been under great pressure from the state because of problems of ethnic clashes within the country and sort of associated risks around separatism and terrorism that have expressed themselves. And what we've seen is the Chinese government has sort of clamped down quite heavily on them at home, and we've seen the result has been a lot of people trying to leave the country, but also occasional expressions of anger outside the country where some of this community have been radicalized to the point of wanting to express their anger against the Chinese state using terrorist violence. And we've seen attempts at that in a number of different contexts. There is also a historically substantial community of radicalized Uyghurs who have in the past set up bases under the Taliban's Afghanistan, and more recently had moved into Pakistan, but recently moved back into Afghanistan and appear to be from there talking about trying to launch jihad against China.
To some extent, the dynamics of this attack reminded me a little bit of the Tiananmen Square attack in 2013, in which a car crashed into a gate, killing five people. It seems a little similar.
I mean, there are possible similarities. I mean, if we look at the, we don't know the details of the device yet, but certainly if we look at the images that emerged from the embassy, it looks like it was quite a large bang, but it's not clear how large the crater was, which suggests it might have been a more homemade sort of device than something else, which suggests a level of maybe amateurishness that would be surprising if, for example, of an Al-Qaeda-directed or plotted attack, or even ISIL-directed or plotted attack, where maybe the individuals would have had the sort of training to build a much larger, more sophisticated device. The fact that, in essence, the driver appears to have been the person who was killed and the other people were just sort of injured nearby, certainly, again, suggests sort of a level of failed success, which in some ways is emulates what we saw happen in Beijing, where we saw the individuals driving through crowds, but ultimately not killing that many people except for themselves. So there are sort of similarities there. I think the distinction probably lies in the fact that, here at least the device appears to have generated a large explosion. People in Bishkek report hearing a large explosion, whereas it's not totally clear that the device that went off in Beijing actually generated a large explosion rather than just setting the car on fire.
Is it known about, say, a Uyghur presence or Uyghur connections to Kyrgyzstan?
I mean, there is a minority community of Uyghurs who live in Kyrgyzstan, in much the same way that you've got substantial minorities living in neighboring Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan as well, and also a very large minority in Turkey. So there's a kind of diaspora community there. But, I think that whether those particular Uyghurs who are based there are connected to this particular attack, it's not very clear. I think that the local authorities there have been fairly pliant when the Chinese government has asked them to clamp down on sort of Uyghur dissidents that they're unhappy at in Kyrgyzstan. But I think there's a question there about the local government's capacity to sort of manage some of these problems.
Raffaello Pantucci, he's the Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute in London. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
International Edition. Well, imagine the surprise of fellow potential jurors when they found themselves in the same room with one of pop music's biggest stars. That's what happened to would-be jurors in Nashville, Tennessee, when they found that Taylor Swift was also a potential juror in an aggravated rape case. Jury service is a civic duty here in the United States. The 26-year-old Swift was ultimately excused from jury duty because of a potential conflict of interest with a case the star is pursuing in which she was allegedly groped by a local DJ. But before leaving, Swift took time to pose with fans for some photos that made their way onto social media. I bet she had some pretty excited fellow would-be jurors there. Well, VOA Border Crossings host Larry London joins me now with a new single by a young woman from north of the United States.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for having me on the show. And today we're going to shine the spotlight on a 20-year-old pop star who is on the rise. She's from Canada, and her name is Alicia Cara. And she came on the scene about a year ago with a song which she put out called Here, which was actually written because of a party. It's about a party that's going not too well. She's not happy, and what am I doing here? And so she was inspired by an actual experience. In fact, the music video featured some of her friends who attended the party with her. And then she made it big a year ago on the pop charts and then followed that with Wild Thing. She was on tour this past year for her debut album, Know It All, and now she's out with her third single, actually fourth. But that's not what we're going to feature today. Today we're featuring the third single because it carries a social message with it.
And what is that social message?
Well, okay, I'm glad you asked. The social message, well, first of all, it'll be pretty obvious when I tell you the song title. The song is called Scars to Your Beautiful. Now, there seems to be an ongoing movement now with a lot of different stars and celebrities who are in the spotlight to bring attention to the fact that we don't have to look beautiful to be beautiful. And it's body image, self-awareness, that seems to be the in thing now. In fact, Alicia Keys and Alicia Cara both went to the MTV Video Music Awards show Sunday without makeup. And it was their statement to say that women in particular are judged by how they look. And they want to say that you can be beautiful without getting all made up and fancy hair and makeup and accept people the way they are. Now, this particular song for Alicia Cara, Scars to Your Beautiful, features a bunch of people who've had different, shall we say, physical imperfections, scars, physical scars, and also some emotional scars, too. But it's just like a montage of different people's faces. And, it you know, everybody's kind of there as a statement to you can be beautiful with scars.
She just wants to be beautiful. She goes unnoticed. She knows no limits. She craves attention. She praises an image. She prays to be sculpted by the sculptor.
There are a number of pop stars from Canada these
It's
days.
Amazing. Justin Bieber and The Weeknd and Drake, and the list goes on. And you can add Alicia Cara to that list now. And in fact, in her own country, Canada, Ontario, Canada, she won the Juno Award this past year for Breakthrough Artist of the Year. The Juno Awards are equivalent to the Grammys for Canada. And so she's been nominated for all kinds of awards, has won quite a few. The Much Music Video Awards gave her Best New Canadian Artist. And she was just nominated on Sunday at the MTV Video Music Awards show for Best Pop Video for her previous single, Wild Things. She did perform the new single with Troy Sivan on the show. And she's only 20. And she's already getting started. She got discovered at 13 by posting videos on YouTube.
Wow.
Which seems to be the thing to do these days if you want to get discovered. So she did that. She's been writing songs since she was about 10. Very talented young lady. I had her on Border Crossings. A pleasure to talk to her. And she is going out on tour with Coldplay. So that's a big act to get a lot of exposure with as they continue their European tour.
Yeah, and varying age groups, I think, among the fans.
Exactly. And one thing that she did tell me when I interviewed her is that her brother, she's got a younger brother who likes to say, "I'm Alicia's brother," and he signs autographs as her younger brother. So he's enjoying the fame probably a little more than she is right now.
Thanks a lot. That's VOA Border Crossings host Larry London. There's a hope that's waiting for you in the dark. You should know you're beautiful just the way you are. And you don't have to change a thing. The world could change its heart. No scars, see you're beautiful. We stars and we're beautiful. And that is the music of Alicia Carey. That's also our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. There are a whole range of stories, news, features that might interest you. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For people living in former conflict zones, war may not end for years after the last shot has been fired and the peace agreement is signed. Landmines and unexploded munitions, remnants of the war between the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia and the Colombian government, stand in the way of post-accord stabilization and reconstruction and inhibit long-term development. They render millions of hectares of land unusable, preventing farmers from tending their fields and herders from pasturing their cattle. In many regions of Colombia, ordinary travel is dangerous because roads are lined with minefields, and a misstep could cost a passerby his or her life. Even everyday activities like gathering wood or forest fruits, hauling produce to the market, or even taking a shortcut through the fields are fraught with danger. Too many children have lost their lives and limbs chasing a stray soccer ball into a minefield. The United States and Norway have long worked together to remove and destroy landmines and unexploded ordnance. This partnership has saved thousands of lives and helped rebuild post-conflict communities around the world. In February, the two countries founded the Global Demining Initiative for Colombia, a program to help Colombia rid itself of explosive remnants of war left over from more than five decades of conflict, which has ended with a peace agreement announced August 24th. Since then, 22 countries plus the European Union have committed to the initiative. And in late July, the two partner countries created the U.S.-Norwegian Demining Initiative, which will support mine clearance in Syrian and Iraqi areas that have been liberated from ISIL. While more government-to-government cooperation is important, we need all the help we can get to address the challenges of landmines and unexploded ordnance, wrote Rose Guttmuller, Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, in a recent blog post. The Colombia Initiative has shown the importance of engaging many partners, including governments, NGOs, civil society, and the private sector in the demining effort. Regional public-private partnerships can generate fresh ideas, find new ways to help safely clear unexploded ordnance in post-conflict countries. International support, not only from governments, is essential to saving lives and preventing injuries in the aftermath of war, wrote Undersecretary Guttmuller. Nations and civil society, including businesses, can work together to ensure that all people are able to walk the earth in safety.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.